Homeless people, they're some of the most vulnerable and misunderstood folks in our communities. Season 3 of Local Folks Podcast, Helping the Homeless, is dedicated to telling the story of how a group of local people is working to provide needed services to folks who are experiencing homelessness. Episode 1 introduces the Corvallis Daytime Drop-In Center and the people at the center who give and receive help and support. You can find Local Folks at kboo.fm. Go to audio, podcasts, and click on Local Folks.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, Portland. This is Labor Radio. I am your host, Michael Cathcart. Joining me tonight,
as always, is Elliot Gilliland. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. And we are coming to you live, or not live, we are just coming to you from the KBOO studios here in beautiful Portland, Oregon. Tonight we have a number of topics to go over, the first of which will be discussing the new developments in the Burgerville boycott and the union that's been formed by workers there. Later we'll be talking about the Chicago teacher strike and some Amazon updates, as well as a few other things. But to start things off here, regular listeners of the Third Monday editions of Labor Radio will remember a show I did about 6 months ago, 5 months ago or so, mm-hmm. in the springtime, just as Major League Baseball season was starting, talking about an effort within the Major League Baseball Players Association, the union for ballplayers, to save the union jobs that had been existed for the last 60 years in a town in upstate New York near Buffalo, producing the hats, the new era hats, the fitted caps that everyone buys, particularly for the folks, the ball players on the field, but also for fans and everyone like that. You know, it was a pretty interesting fight. Unfortunately, you know, the jobs were not saved. They were shipped down to Florida to a non-union shop. But the reason I bring it up is because the main organizer of that, Sean Doolittle, who is a relief pitcher for the Washington Nationals, he and his team, and he's a big part of the reason they are now going to the World Series. So, you know, despite the fact that his team defeated my beloved Dodgers, I still wish him good luck and solidarity to him. So let's see how they do.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to point out it's another example over the last couple months of us doing this show of a union, or in this case the MLBPA Players Association, supporting another union. Exactly. We saw it multiple times with a lot of environmental stuff over the last couple episodes, which we won't dive back into, but I think it's really great to see that kind of, you know, support across different industries and things like that. So
absolutely, and that's sort of a running theme that we like to bring up on the show is really just showing the power that exists when workers organize across bounds, you know, so not just in their own workplace, but when there's solidarity, shows of support from people across, you know, the working class. And so that is, you know, even though these ball players make millions of dollars, they, you know, they still do work for a living and they still are part of a union. So they are, you know, I guess, mm-hmm. considered part,
I mean,
of the working
class. And we've seen professionals, you know, athletes put their opinions out there,
yes.
and it not go well for them. So
right.
I don't think it's just something Sean is doing
exactly.
For no reason. It's something he believes in, and that's really great to see.
Absolutely, yeah. And he still stands by it, so, you know, more power to him. Mm-hmm. So go Nationals, I suppose. Although I take that back. Anyways, moving right along. The first story that we'd like to discuss tonight is the recent developments with the Burgerville Union, the workers at a number of Burgerville franchises or locations in the Northwest.
Which, for people who don't know, is a fast food chain that exists in Oregon and also Southern Washington.
Yeah.
And I think they have about 1,500 employees.
Yeah, somewhere around that,
yeah.
I believe. Yeah, they do. They specialize in burgers. It's sort of a local, you know, version of any local burger shop.
Mm-hmm.
But the workers in a number of those places have organized a union. About 3 years ago, they petitioned to start a union, the Burgerville Workers Union. And this, they've been working they came with demands to the management, and they have been negotiating in the negotiation process for a while. But unfortunately, the negotiations fell apart very recently. So on
Friday.
Exactly. So Friday, which would be October 18th, I believe. And management, you know, one of the things that they were asking, the big thing that the workers were asking for was, you know, $5 an hour raises, affordable health care, fair scheduling, and things like that. And management came back to them offering, and not only to them, but to all workers at Burger, so all Burgerville workers, offering a $1 pay raise beginning next year, which is, you know, far short, falls far short of what the demands from the union were. So the union has called for a boycott of Burgerville, and all week they are on strike, and they are holding actions every single day of the week outside of Burgerville locations and in other places. So, you know, this is a big, the Northwest has been kind of a hotbed for fast food organizing over the last few years. You know, that's a sector that I think only recently became, you know, in the cultural consciousness, a part of the working class, you know, service work, and particularly like fast food and restaurant
and McDonald's has come up in the spotlight multiple times. And I think these types of things also bring up a lot of activity online. And I think a lot of people see these fast food jobs as high school or kind of starter opportunities, because that's what either they did growing up, or it's just in the societal norm.
Yeah, it's that like 50s cliche. You
know? Yeah. But more and more, we're actually seeing people get stuck in and around these types of entry level positions. And it's important to remind yourself that these people are actually human behind the counter. And in most cases, whatever you're buying, the people making it deserve to make a livable wage. It's not really about justifying or normalizing low wage jobs because we expect workers to kind of move on from them.
Right.
You know, whatever it is you're buying, that seems to be kind of the right thing to do, right? And so to kind of push back against that kind of high school or starter opportunities, we put together some stats. So 40% of the workforce in the fast food industry is actually 25 years or older, and the average fast food worker is 29 years old. 26% of fast food workers are parents with children. And it's also really important to note that 31% of workers at fast food restaurants have at least attempted college, but for one reason or another had to drop out. According to the National Employment Law Project, up to 50% of fast food workers have more than one job, and often that second job is another minimum wage or low-paying job that requires equally long hours. So for fast food workers, kind of making ends meet is a kind of a 24-hour a day process. And you know, kind of putting that in perspective, I think it's up to the consumers with greater privilege to kind of stand in solidarity with those who are fighting, right, to Absolutely. Survive in this industry. And I think that's just, you know, before we dive in, it's important to kind of think about, you know, that. And these aren't just jobs that, you know, it's, we want to justify as like a corporate kind of, hey, you know, these are starter opportunities where people are going to move on so we can get away with lower wages. That's not really kind of the actual narrative that's playing out.
Right. And, you know, like one of the things that, you know, so in their demands, the obvious thing or the common thing is, you know, asking for pay raises and affordable health care and things like that. But one of the things that you see coming up more and more when, you know, discussing service workers as opposed to, you know, your traditional, what you think of as working class employees, you know, whether that's a factory or something like that, mm-hmm. is fair scheduling, which is another thing on their list. And, you know, it's maybe a, you know, not something you think of right away when you think of like the track or the malfactors of a job. But, you know, if you work, anyone who's worked service will definitely know this, but if you work a job at a place such as a restaurant where it's open all the time and shifts need to be filled constantly, and you work with, you know, largely a precarious workforce, there's going to be, you know, you maybe get your schedule a week or 2 weeks in advance, and oftentimes the schedule changes week to week. And that's, you know, it's hard to plan a life around that, let alone, you know, if you're an individual, if you're a single young person, it's hard enough to plan any type of, you know, social life or anything else like that, you know, whether you're going to school or not. But imagine if you have a family, if you're supporting children, if you're a single
parent.
And
you have a second job, exactly. which also has scheduling issues. It's pretty easy to get trapped here. And especially with the cost of education going up, you know, a lot of the online activity I saw was, you know, well, this is what you do before you, you know, go to school and earn kind of a better wage, but that's just not always possible for everyone. And I think it really just goes back to the point of whatever it is you're buying, the people making it or providing the service for it deserve a livable wage, and this is just another example.
Right. And, you know, just like you're saying, you know, a lot of the discourse around these jobs not only is, oh, this is, you know, an entry-level job or this is a starter job for you know, children or for, you know, students or for
or, you know,
people.
You can be replaced off the street by anyone, so therefore you don't deserve, you know, the wage. That was a lot of rhetoric that I saw kind of going around.
That does, yeah, I mean, that's, I feel like that's the most common thing is like, well, you know, what have you done to deserve this? Mm-hmm. But just to put it in perspective, so the raise offered by management, by Burgerville Management, is essentially $1 an hour for all employees. For Oregon workers, that $1 an hour would essentially equal out to 25 cents over the minimum wage when that's increased next July. And then for Washington workers, that would essentially put them at the minimum wage when it goes up again next year. So, you know, as much as, well, why do you, you know, people say, why do you deserve that? Or, you know, this job shouldn't pay much. If you think about the fact that that is exactly at the minimum wage line.
Yeah.
That means that, you know, these people who are producing your food, who, you know, are working quickly and efficiently, are working a very precarious schedule, you know, giving their time and money over, or time and effort over to providing you with food. These people are barely making minimum wage, you know, once it goes up. I think that just sort of puts it a little bit in perspective there, why that's a little bit of a ridiculous argument.
Yep.
Aside from the moral argument that, like, anyone who works for a living, or even, you know, anyone who works should be earning enough to live comfortably, or, you know, reasonably.
Yeah, it's not, it shouldn't be seen as kind of a victory for the union. This is them saying, okay, we'll do what the, you know, the federal or state government has stated, so.
Yeah. And for their part, the management have done it, you know, made a big show of, you know, whether or not you take it in good faith, they made a big press announcement saying that they were going to take out like $1 million loan or, you know, some large...
$3 million.
$3 million, yeah, thank you. Yeah, $3 million loan in order to be able to cover the $1 wage increase for all the workers. Now, you know, that was broadcast to the media, and that was more likely than not a bargaining tactic. And the union responded to it by, you know, calling the proposed increase, you know, it's not a good faith effort to work with the union to improve working conditions, but rather an attempt to sidestep the union altogether. Which, if you do consider, you know, management's role in that and the way that they did present it, it does seem to be the case. And, you know, so just going back to the theme that we do talk about a lot, the show of solidarity across, you know, workplaces and across different sectors of the working class. So, you know, not only are these workers from, there's about five stores have joined the union, so about 12% of the workforce at Burgerville. Not only are they out, you know, boycotting and picketing, but the Little Big Union, which is the union for workers at Little Big Burger here, another fast food chain in the Portland, Oregon region. I believe they've also moved else, you know, they've opened up elsewhere. Workers from that union have also pledged to support the picketing as well.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, a union in the same industry, but across different, you know, company lines, different unions supporting each other, showing solidarity, and that is really what it takes to win these victories. Mm-hmm. The workers themselves, the Burgerville workers, you know, they're asking of the public, they're calling on workers and just, you know, consumers and the public in general to boycott Burgerville and to join them on the picket line if they can, or to donate funds to their strike fund. They have a GoFundMe page, which can be found at BVWU Strike and Hardship Fundraiser on the GoFundMe website. You can also learn more about what they are, you know, what they're asking for, the union itself, and also the events that they do have coming up this week, the boycott events that they're having. If you go to the website boycottburgerville.com, or you can also follow them on Twitter. Their handle is at BVWKRUnion. So that's, again, on Twitter. You can find out more information there, how to get involved and how to support them.
Yeah.
Another way that, you know, is personal to me that they are asking folks to support is they have a call for artists to boycott Burgerville, and they have a campaign going called Bands Against Burgerville, which it's asking that bands that, you know, local area bands, and even, you know, if there are bands elsewhere, it's asking them to talk about the issue, the boycott on stage when they're performing, including, you know, to include Bands Against Burgerville on their graphics, you know, that graphic on their promotion materials or anything that they put out, and to use the hashtag Boycott Burgerville on their social media posts. There are notable bands from the local area that have already signed on to this, that are already a part of it, most notably And, Black Belt Eagle Scout, Cool Original, Strange Ranger, Turtlenecked, and hopefully soon to be, once I discuss it with my bandmates, my own personal band, Stoner Control. That would be great. I think that that's something we absolutely need to get on board with and support. And one final, you know, funny element to this whole thing, if there is any humor in it. Recently, Ice Cube, the rapper slash actor slash mogul, I imagine, he was recently seen eating at the Burgerville at the Portland Airport, the PDX Burgerville, and people saw him there and reached out to him on social media, asking him to, you know, letting him know he crossed the picket line and asking him to support the boycott, because he is a member of SAG-AFTRA, which is part of the AFL-CIO, which is the largest labor union in the country. So,
yeah, that was funny. I saw that, but I didn't see if he replied or not.
Thus far, I haven't seen anything on there. He may be fully unaware that he did that at all.
I'm sure. Yeah, he was just, you know, headed to the airport.
And he's probably not even the one who checks his own social media, but still, it's, you know, trying to get some notoriety or some attention there. So, you know, that's our segment there. For those of you who are just joining us now, just tuning in, welcome. This is Labor Radio. We are coming to you from the KBOO Studios in Portland, Oregon. I am Michael Cathcart, joining me, as always,
Elliot Gilliland.
Yeah. And we just finished discussing the Burgerville strike. We're now going to start talking, just do a little update about the Chicago teachers strike that, if you listened last week, it was discussed in more depth, but the strike has actually begun as of Thursday, October 17th. So worker or educators, the 25,000 educators with the Chicago Teachers Union have walked out. They are on their third day of a massive strike there. They are asking for their demands include, you know, we've seen this and we've discussed this. There have been teacher strikes over the past few years all around the country.
Yep.
It's really amazing. They're asking for smaller class sizes. They're saying that over 41,000 elementary students are in classes of 30-plus students. And at all levels of education, public education in Chicago, there are regularly classes of over 40 students.
Which is crazy.
I mean, I don't know how you even learn in that environment, how you get any attention from the teacher at all, you know, especially if it's maybe just one teacher. And you know, part of the walkout is also not only is it the teachers walking out, but they are also, they coordinate it with the support staff from the schools who are, you know, people like teachers' aides who are represented by the SEIU Local 73.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there may be one teacher's aide and one teacher in a classroom of potentially 40 students. I mean, that's just, I don't know how you learn anything or how you get, you know, any special attention or any questions answered.
I thought it was interesting too in the demands, just to go back to is also just a lot of kind of support for students. So I saw in there like more counselors, which I think in this day and age is also really important with kind of the mental health issues that we've been seeing across the entire country. Kind of getting that resource available to students is really important. And then also bilingual kind of options and teachers there I think is really important too. When you get into these kind of communities and neighborhoods where, you know, English isn't always the primary language, it's really important to help, you know, people move forward by speaking the language that they also speak. So,
right. Yeah. I mean, so that's, all those things are really important. And the, you know, this is not the first time that the Chicago teachers have gone on strike. In 2012, they went on strike.
Yeah.
You know, it was a landmark strike that they went on. Right now, they're saying that the city is basically constantly operating in a situation of, you know, a state of crisis when it comes to funding education, and they believe that the city has changed their funding mechanism, so they actually have an extra $1 billion allocated towards funding education in that city than they did in 2012 when the last time they struck. So there should be more money to be used towards meeting some of these critical needs for students and teachers.
Yep.
So, you know, solidarity to them, and we will keep you up to date.
I mean, strikes, like, I think education strikes in particular are just really intense for communities at large, because it's not only affecting the corporation, you know, like in the case of Burgerville, it's kind of affecting the families. This is a place they send their children every single day, excluding weekends. And when it's not open, that can cause huge problems. And I think it's important, you know, as a union to address those things and kind of acknowledge them, which I believe they did.
Yeah.
There's some quotes out there. And so, you know, just making sure that, you know, the process is at least moving forward to some sort of resolution. And obviously we'll, as news breaks, we'll be here to kind of fill people in.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to address that, you're right. The union made us put out a statement that said that we understand that a strike is a disruption to the parents of the city. It's worth a short-term disruption that puts in place over the long term conditions that make education better in the city.
Yeah, and so I think that's where it's important to note that their demands weren't just, you know, wages and, you know, better working conditions or healthcare. It was the things we talked about, counselors and kind of bilingual teachers and librarians and things of that nature.
Yeah, because, you know, as is maybe often forgot, but their working environment is these parents' children's learning environment.
Yep.
And so it's, you know, they're doing as much for the kids as they are for themselves. So moving along from that, and we will, as Elliot said, we will keep you updated on that as things develop. But moving along from that, we are moving into another section here. I like to call this section Amazon Watch.
It yep. is and it happens a lot here
yes.
on Labor Radio.
Unfortunately, Amazon does not get better, the company that is. And so they need to, you know, they need to have an eye kept on them, because they are one of the more,
just largest employers.
Yeah, exactly.
I think, you know, regardless of, they would be on this, you know, show, whether or not it's good or bad, just due to the sheer number of people they employ.
Exactly.
And the sheer growth, as we've talked about, of just the warehouse and shipping and all that kind
yeah.
of stuff. And, you know, the 2-hour delivery. And
how
like
much
that.
They've displaced other elements of ours, you know, how much they've just basically taken over all elements of our economy and our, you know, society in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
Not only the, you know, the products they sell us, but also, you know, behind the scenes running the Amazon, the web services that they do.
Exactly.
But this is, we have a few stories here to discuss that basically provide a peek behind the curtain and give us a bit more insight into the dangerous and exploitative labor practices that has made Jeff Bezos the richest person in the history of riches, in the history of humankind, which is pretty amazing. But Amazon recently, I believe it was, you know, this month, was placed on the National Council for Occupational Safety and Health. The Council for Occupational Safety and Health. They were placed on their Dirty Dozen list, which is a list of the 12 most dangerous employers in the United States. Mm-hmm. The council cited the high number of workers attempting workers' suicide attempts, overworked employees urinating in bottles to avoid punishment, poor treatment of contract temp workers, and a few other things. Which, you know, we've discussed all these things, particularly the poor treatment of temp workers before. But yeah, that's, you know, this is now an official report from a national labor body that is calling this out. The Daily Beast reported that from 2013 to 2018, 911 was called to warehouses 189 times for suicide attempts and threats of suicide, which is astonishing. I mean, there are, you know, they have something like 250,000 employees around the country, but still, that's a pretty high number.
And my understanding is that in multiple cases of this, during the 911 call and while they were there, the workers were expected to continue working.
Yes.
Which is pretty insane when you think about it. And there weren't any stoppages.
Right.
You know, when you're working in this kind of Amazon razor thin margin format, there just isn't, in their business model, they have not kind of created space for humans.
Right.
So there isn't really any room for stoppages, even if there are humans that are basically in those warehouses having a terrible time,
yeah.
right? And living and working in these conditions that just kind of aren't sustainable.
Yeah, exactly. As much as the company, from an outward perspective, is focused almost entirely on humans and creating the most comfort and the most
yep.
ease for people, the way that
the
know,
delivery mechanisms
exactly.
are not configured in such a manner. Yeah.
Yeah, the corporate culture and the way that, you know, the way that you get things as convenient as they provide is by squeezing as much as they can out of employees and basically treating them inhumanely. The council's report states that this is a quote from that, the e-commerce giant posted $11.2 billion in profits in 2018 while paying no federal income tax. Despite the vast resources, there's little evidence that the company has made any significant efforts to address worker complaints about stress, overwork, and other conditions, which can lead to illness, injuries, and fatalities. And they were, of course, you know, placed on this list last year's version of this list as well. So yeah. Nothing has improved in the past year.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and I think, you know, this has been in the news for a while. Like in July, I believe several federal legislators asked OSHA officially to investigate the working conditions in a lot of those warehouses. Right. And Bernie Sanders, you know, as we reported, was kind of one of the big ones there. And I know in a blog post earlier this year, in kind of response to that, Amazon claimed to have spent $55 million on safety improvements since 2018 in all of their warehouses. However, in an OSHA report from kind of that time period, July, Amazon had been inspected 150 times by OSHA and had been issued 41 violations.
Wow.
They've also been accused numerous times of failing to report worker injuries, which is a big kind of
right.
thing that OSHA looks out for, including fractures and amputations. Which is in addition to kind of this suicide stuff. So, I actually think for the sheer number of warehouses that they have, that 150 inspections is really low.
Right. And it probably says a lot to the fact that they're somehow skirting around.
Yeah. This. And I think that's what made it so important that, you know, a bunch of representatives, including Bernie Sanders, kind of were making a big push to kind of get this stuff a little bit more investigated by OSHA, just because of the sheer number of workers and warehouses that Amazon is in possession of.
Yeah, and if you think about the time frame that you just mentioned there about the investigations that have happened, I mean, that falls well within the Trump administration's reign. And, you know, regulatory bodies or oversight bodies like OSHA have been drastically, you know, curtailed. Their ability to have any effect on workplaces has been curtailed. So for there to be that many cases looked at is pretty astonishing, even though it is a small number compared to how many people work there. Along with that, the report from the National Council on Occupational Safety and Health also noted that there were 6 worker deaths in fulfillment centers, Amazon fulfillment centers, so Amazon warehouses, between November 2018 and April 2019, which, I mean, is, like, I guess I don't know the numbers for all workplaces and how many deaths occur on the job, but I don't think that the average workplace you operate in sees that many deaths.
Yep.
In that short time
and
span.
And going back to a previous segment, I think it's important to note the ages of a lot of these people, because this kind of popped up in the news from a 48-year-old who died of a heart attack. But in addition to that, back in March, you know, we talked about a 60-year-old man who also died from a heart attack.
Right.
And again, that was another example of the supervisor basically telling the workforce to continue working while this person was on the ground. So
yeah,
the ages of these people, similarly to, you know, fast food industry, are not as young and spry as you would think. And they're kind of doing a job that is maybe not designed for them.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing that you hear over and over again from these employees is just the pace of the work, the quotas that they're given, that dictate the pace that they have to work at is unmanageable. I mean, yeah, one of the things that I mentioned before was overworked employees urinating in bottles to avoid punishment. I mean, what that comes from is that, you know, you work inside one of those factories and they may be the size of the length of like multiple football fields, and you are required to, you get a list of things, you constantly get pinged, you have to run around, and the bathroom may be at the other end of the facility, and if you have 10 things in your queue that you need to get and you need to go to the bathroom, you don't have time to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have time to run all the way across there and come back. So workers have found it much easier to just urinate in bottles and leave it around.
Yeah, and something I think that's not brought up enough either is that I believe Amazon has discussed shortening the shipping time for Amazon Prime.
Yes.
So not only is that going to affect the current people there, but I'm assuming they're going to have to bring in even more people to hit those deadlines who are going to be under the gun just as much. So.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's something that we discussed a few months ago during Amazon Prime Day. But
yep.
Yeah, reducing the amount of time it takes to get something to the customer just puts more of a squeeze on these workers, which, you know, we will continue to cover these issues as they come up. Unfortunately, we are running out of time. There are even more things that we could talk about right here, more ways that Amazon has been cited. One thing that I will just bring up quickly is that the New York Committee for Occupational Safety and Health, so that is the New York version of that committee, just came up with a report that basically determined that Amazon, the warehouse in Staten Island, is an extremely dangerous place to work, and the report describes a product obsessive culture. They found the injury rate at that facility to be nearly three times the national average for warehouse workers. Mm-hmm. And the recommendation for how to mitigate those injuries is to allow the workers to unionize.
Yep.
That's what they said. So with that, we will have to leave it there. You have been listening to Labor Radio. I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilland.
If you want to continue this conversation, you can find me on Twitter at Michael B. Cath.
Just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up. It's Labor Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Get Kids Outdoors Dinner on Friday, October 25th from 6 to 9 p.m. at EcoTrust in Portland. The Get Kids Outdoors Dinner supports Betty's 360 and Urban Nature Partners, two youth mentoring organizations that look to create more equitable access to the outdoors for historically marginalized communities in Portland. There will be dinner, drinks, silent auctions, raffles, and the opportunity to learn more about both organizations. Again, that's the Get Kids Outdoors Dinner on Friday, October 25th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Billy Frank Jr. Conference Center at EcoTrust, 721 Northwest 9th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Opioid overdose is a leading cause of death for people releasing from prison. A new pilot program at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, Oregon's only women's prison, begins treatment for women diagnosed with opioid use disorder prior to their release from prison and connects them to community-based treatment upon release. Join me on Prison Pipeline to learn more about this innovative program.